Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is November 30th, 2023, and we're talking with Rebecca Shansky, professor in the Department of Psychology at Northeastern University. Rebecca's lab works on emotional learning, fear learning. She uses behavioral measures, neuroanatomical methods, and various circuit manipulations to study the brain circuits responsible for fear-driven behavior and for learning of fear-driven behavior. And included in that is a study of sex differences in fear learning. So thank you for joining us, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
So also with us today is Morgan Johnston, a PhD student in our program here at NDRB and an expert on behavior and learning and emotional learning, but not usually fear, I think.
Reward learning,
that's
yeah.
Right, reward
so
learning. That's
opposite, another, but the same.
It's the opposite, isn't it? So, and Matt Wonnett, longtime podcast regular and expert on many brain behavior and learning things. Hi, Matt.
Howdy.
Okay, Rebecca, I'm really interested in the brain circuit that's responsible for fear conditioning, and I know it's been studied. It's one of the most thoroughly studied learning circuits in the mammalian brain, and I wonder if you could kind of give us a quick overview about what we know about that circuit, the components of it, and then what we know, what we don't know, what we wish we knew about it.
So I think there's definitely not just one circuit. I think the number of brain regions that contribute to what we consider associative learning seems to grow every year. I think if you looked at papers maybe back in the 90s or 80s even, where people thought that, you know, the circuits that people were looking at were essentially, where does the sensory input come into, where does information about so associative learning and fear conditioning is about the animal learning to associate that neutral stimulus, the tone, with a foot shock, right? So that requires auditory input and pain or sensory input to converge somewhere in order for the animal to form that association. And so for a very long time, it was taken essentially that the circuit was the sensory input comes in through the thalamus, converges in the lateral amygdala, and then that will contribute to downstream behavioral responses based on that. Since then, we've learned that there are any number of other brain regions that can contribute to the information that the animal processes as a part of that learning experience, and that includes areas of the prefrontal cortex, of the hippocampus, stress-related signaling from, you know, hypothalamus, the periaqueductal gray. The list goes on and
on. So some of those that you mentioned are sort of upstream of the association, maybe, and some of them are kind of downstream, connecting it to behavior.
Right.
Could you distinguish which are which? Is it distinguishable?
So it is distinguishable, but I think, I'm sorry, you're asking a much more complicated question than
you
might realize.
We're interested in the complicated stuff.
It is the brain. So to put things in perspective, I teach an entire semester-long course on the neuropsychology of fear. So we're maybe not going
to
get through everything in a half an hour. So I think canonically, right, you think about upstream processing as things that happen in the cortex, maybe the hippocampus, right? These are the more upper-level aspects that kind of give texture to the experience, whereas somewhere like the periaqueductal gray would be involved in generating the behavioral response that you would see. I think the lines are becoming a little bit more blurred these days, and there's evidence that even within the PAG, there is some processing going on, and it's not just a relay station for generating a freezing response, even though you could, for example, just directly go into the VPAG and stimulate it, and you would probably get the animal to freeze, even if it hadn't learned anything. So there's different levels to what these different brain regions are able to contribute, and I think it kind of depends on the experimental approach you're using to actually ask those questions.
But of course, somewhere, because there's more than one possible behavior, and somewhere behaviors have to be selected, and somewhere the association between the conditioned and unconditioned stimulus has to be made. And it could all be happening everywhere, I suppose, but
yeah.
But certainly the motor neurons are probably just part of the efferent part, and that, and the cochlea is part of that, of this tone detecting part.
Yes. So 100%. Like there, when you're getting down into the nitty gritty of like motor neurons and sensory neurons, those you can probably know what their role
those
is.
Those handle all kinds of stimuli and all kinds of movements. Mm-hmm. So if we say fear, we identify fear responses because they are a certain kind of movement, right? So usually freezing, I guess, but maybe you could instruct us that it's not always freezing.
Yeah. So freezing has been the canonical fear response in Pavlovian fear conditioning, not necessarily in other kinds of studies of fear, but for as far as associative learning goes, for decades, the only behavioral metric that we use to determine as behavioral neuroscience that the animal has learned has been, is it freezing or not freezing?
So that's sort of interesting from a historical perspective, because how do we pick something like that? I mean, it's true that the field tends to like pick something and say, let's all work on that and we'll all concentrate on that. And that's good in a way, because it gets, it motivates the whole group towards something. But in some ways, it's an arbitrary decision. If you just tell me when you're scared, you might freeze, I would say, yeah, I understand that. I know people do that too. Mm-hmm. But it's not the only thing people do when they're afraid.
Sure, and, yeah.
So why was it that people decided we're going to measure freezing?
Well, I think it comes down to, in a lot of ways, from like a practical standpoint, freezing is very recognizable. It's easy to quantify if you're just looking at the amount of time an animal spends doing freezing.
And some undergraduate sitting there.
Yeah. And you know, if like freezing as the preferred metric came about probably in like the late 70s, early 80s, and you know, we didn't have machine learning, video scoring.
Just people with stopwatches.
It was just people with stopwatches. And so, I really think it became, and it probably, those people saw other behaviors sometimes and they were like, I don't know how to count that. So they just didn't do it. And it was more just a question of whatever was essentially the simplest and most reliable. And so that was what they did. And I think it's understandable. Scientists want things to be replicable. They want things to be straightforward. And so it's understandable that this is what happened. But I think now we have the power to not have to be that limited in terms of how we understand behavior. And so we shouldn't be.
So what are some of the other behaviors that you might be looking at that would be a fear response or a threat response or whatever the parlance is of the day?
So in my lab, what we are focusing on is a behavior that we call darting, which is essentially a flight response, an escape-like response that we started capturing or observing only a few years after the lab started, although it's the sort of thing where when we just started noticing darting, and I would give talks and I tell the little story about my grad students saying like, hey, you know, some of these animals are running around. I can see the nods in the audience. Everybody, I think at some point, if you've watched enough fear conditioning videos, has seen this. They just didn't decide to do anything with it, or they didn't see it regularly enough that they knew that it was important. And I think part of that is because people were only studying male animals, and we see this behavior much more frequently in females.
So that's two behaviors. Are they, and so one you mentioned is not moving, and the other one is moving. Are these, should they be thought of as orthogonal to one another, where, okay, if the animal is not freezing, therefore they would be a darter? Or is it even more complicated where, okay, so maybe we've got two behaviors, maybe there are 10 behaviors that we should be looking at? And I know that's goes in a lot of different directions, but
sure, I guess they can't do them both at the same time.
Can't do them both at the same time. So with respect to freezing and darting, what we usually see in the animals that do dart, they also freeze. So it's not like an animal is one or the other. There are many animals that only exhibit freezing behavior and never do any darting. There are animals that start out freezing and then they kind of switch to darting. There are other behaviors that are very, very frequently seen. There is this scanning behavior that they do, which is very creepy. Like they kind of, it's like they're freezing, but then their head kind of sways back and forth. And that is another behavior that like doesn't start until they start getting foot shocks. Like it's clearly some kind of vigilance or other sort of fear response, but because they're swaying, you can't count it as freezing. Freezing is like absolutely no movement at all. They're not darting. So we haven't quite tried to quantify the scanning behavior or swaying behavior yet, but it's definitely something that, you know, for example, deep lab cut could probably help with. There are other things that some researchers are interested in is rearing behavior, although I think there is not a clear way to interpret rearing behavior. Some people think that it means the animal is being exploratory, while other people think it might mean that the animal is, again, it's more like vigilance behavior. So I think, you know, it could be done. Animals will rear pretty frequently, and so you could try and map that onto, for example, how intense the foot shock is, or, you know, with how it maps onto whether they're also doing other things like freezing.
I believe there's some studies that are looking at like elevated plus mazes and rearing behavior, like them trying to look over the walls. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be another one of those instances where like there's a lot of sex differences between how males and females behave in an elevated plus maze, and it seems like the females do more of the, if I'm remembering the studies right, that they do more of the rearing behavior, and in that context, it's interpreted as like exploratory.
Mm-hmm. So maybe to circle back to where Charlie was at, so we've got a bunch of different behaviors mm-hmm. that are happening here, and they can be all conditioned. I mean, you showed that the darting behavior and the freezing can increase over time in response to the cue, maybe mm-hmm. rearing, maybe these other ones. I mean, maybe there's the pupil dilation. I mean, there's a whole host of things you could imagine that probably are happening. So is there a central zone where all of these behaviors are like sort of stored? I mean, they're hardwired in there. You know, these aren't de novo. They're part of their natural repertoire.
Seem like syllables, almost syllables of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then we've got the inputs that are coming in here. Is there sort of a centralized area where then, okay, it sort of preferentially is, okay, I'm going to be a little bit more of a darter, I'm going to be more of a freezer, and does this potentially map onto maybe some sex differences in the brain? And do you have any evidence to suggest there might be some sex differences in how the brain, because as you mentioned, the darting is more prevalent in females as opposed to males, mm-hmm. and so...
Yeah, I mean, so this is what we're looking for. And, you know, the kind of traditional method for understanding what brain regions correspond to different behaviors is to look for immediate early gene expression using something like CFOS. And so we're working on that now. One area that I think is starting to emerge is actually the infralimbic cortex, which is really unusual. People think of the infralimbic cortex as being involved in fear extinction and suppression of freezing behavior, but it may be that the IL is involved in fear conditioning, but it's involved in helping the animal decide which direction to go in. And so my grad student Julia is doing some dreads work now looking at IL projections to either dorsal or ventral PAG, because dorsal PAG is supposed to be about escape behavior and ventral PAG is involved in freezing behavior. And so if the infralimbic cortex projects to both of these different regions with different populations of cells, then you could see the IL as being this executive level like switch where it's saying, okay, now you should dart, now you should freeze, you know, let's try something else. So that's where we are looking right now. We don't have a super clear answer yet. She's not hasn't quite built up the sample sizes that she needs, but things are starting to pull apart in a very interesting darter, non-darter way. We thought just like if you stimulate the IL to DPAG pathway, you're just going to get more darters, and that has not turned out to be the case. But there has been some interesting subgroup divisions that we've seen that are.
So I think one view of this is, which is common and which you may want to refute, is that there's a place where the association takes place that is not cortex. It's amygdala or someplace like that. And then the cortical structures that are involved are sort of top-down supervisors of that, saying, oh, no, don't do that, or don't do that as much, or something like that. But the heart of it is still operating in the amygdala or something, place like that. And then, but this sounds more like a choice of what thing to do rather than whether to be afraid. So the association could still be, there could just be one association. Mm-hmm. This sound means shock. And then other parts of the brain are saying, yes, but what are we going to do about that? And is that consistent with your?
Yes. So, I mean, that's basically how we're thinking about it, because I think if you looked at just freezing behavior data and you saw, okay, males are freezing up here and females are freezing less, you would think that there was a difference in learning between those two groups of animals. And you would say, well, the females are kind of stupid compared to the males. What we're saying is that is not the case, that exactly as you're suggesting, everybody is learning, the association is forming. It's a question of what the behavioral representation of that learning is. And that's why we as behavioral neuroscientists need to expand our repertoire in terms of what we're able to measure behaviorally so that we can accurately judge whether or not an animal has learned. Whether the association is taking place in the exact same part of the brain with the exact same neural mechanisms, that is hard to say right now, because no one has asked these questions in females before, like at the level of where does the sensory input come in? You know, where is the right? So if you had any like n-gram people on the show before, right? Mm-hmm. So where is the n-gram for this tone shock association? Yeah. To my knowledge, no one has shown me the female n-gram.
But if we imagined, that the association was just between the tone and the shock, and then you have an animal, say a female, that will sometimes freeze and sometimes dart, then you don't really you don't really think, do you, that there would be an association associated with freezing and a completely different one for darting, right? It would just be this tone means shock, and then from trial to trial, whatever brain region is deciding what to do about it would be making that independently of that association. And maybe that could involve vast brain regions, actually, that are engaged in decision-making.
I was curious. So, I mean, you've got the sex differences here, and you mentioned that the ACC and the PAG. Is there any evidence to suggest that there might be some sex differences in how these brain regions might be, you know, communicating to one another that might perhaps underlie or play a role in sort of the behaviors that you see?
Yeah, I mean, and specifically with this, the ACC to PAG pathway, all the textbooks say it doesn't exist in males, and we have shown that it actually does exist, especially in females. And so I think this is the kind of what am I trying to say? Like, this is one of these sort of developments where you really recognize that there can be major sexual dimorphisms in the brain in areas that, you know, are really just about organizing behavior, responding to external stimuli that we just haven't explored because everything has been done in males so far. And the ACC is particularly fascinating to me because it's also involved in higher level pain processing. And so because we see these interesting differences in the way that the animals respond to the shock, I feel like the ACC really could be the key to everything. Because it's one thing, I completely agree with you that it may very well be the case that at the level of the the, you know, wherever the cellular representation of the association is, there could be no sex differences at all. But as behavioral neuroscientists, we need accurate behavioral readouts for understanding that that association has happened. And if we don't understand the neural circuits that drive the behaviors that result from the association happening, then we can't, like, the field isn't going to learn anything.
The association is really a hypothetical entity. We have never actually seen it.
Right.
So, though, another one of your discoveries of sexual dimorphism is in the ventral hippocampal to amygdalar pathway, which seems to me that would be more likely to be actually part of the engram formation. Maybe even ventral hippocampus is even a candidate place for that memory storage. And so that would be a possibility for sexually dimorphic learning as well as sexually dimorphic performance, right? Or choice of what to do. Is there any evidence I can tell from what you're saying that there's this confound between how we measure learning and how we measure performance. Mm-hmm. But do we think that there are differences in learning? Do we see anything like a time course of learning or anything like that change?
Based on the behavior, males
and females, based on whatever we can use to try to
So understanding learning, I think, like, this is the major challenge to behavioral neuroscientists, right? Because so we can say, right, so the way that you understand the time course of learning as a fear conditioning researcher and as any kind of probably associated, like, you know, appetitive conditioning, same thing, is you look at the change in behavior with repeated presentations of the associative things, right? And so the, like, steeper the slope, you say the animal learned faster. But again, that's based on your decision of what learning looks like behaviorally in the first place. And so you can do concomitant recordings in the brain, and you can say, well, does the behavior reflect what is actually, you know, activity in the brain? That is helpful. I think it becomes very dangerous to a certain extent to say, oh, males learn faster than females or females learn faster than males, because, again, that's all based on how you defined learning in the first place. And this is something that I think about a lot as a sex differences researcher in terms of the messaging that gets out into the world, because these things can, to a certain extent, be weaponized to change people's rights and things like that. So I think we have to be careful that what you're really saying, your result in the interpretation and the communication of the results, that it's actually, you're very restrained in terms of what you actually have found, right? So we have started not saying males learned better than females if they are freezing more. What we say is males are freezing more, as opposed to putting any kind of value on that.
So maybe part of what's holding us back is that measuring behavior is hard. Yes. And so we find, like, simple shortcuts. I'm just going to measure freezing. I know there's more, but I'm just going to measure that. And my excuse for doing that is things are hard. Life is hard. I'm only me. So what if we could solve those? It seems to me that the solution to that is sort of on the horizon, where we could have a completely assumption-free measure of behavior and just sort of measure everything an animal is doing. Is that something?
Yeah, so that is definitely a thing, and I totally agree with you. I think that behavior development or behavioral metric tool development has been put on the back burner because we had so many amazing advancements in terms of our ability to manipulate and to observe neurons at a cellular level and at a circuit level, that the behavior was like, oh, it's just the output. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't require any level of sophistication. And that's because we're still using behavior tests from the middle of the 20th century. And now I think the pendulum is swinging back a little bit, and we're like, okay, the cellular tools are cool, but they are meaningless if we don't actually know what the behavior is telling us. And so There are lots of great new tools on the horizon that are there for exactly what you're suggesting, unbiased, very, very high resolution behavioral analysis. The best one to my knowledge is called motion sequencing, and that's what Bob Data developed. He's at Harvard Med School, which uses the animal's like 3D position in space across time. The tool is completely unsupervised, and it just tells you what are the behavioral patterns the animal is doing, and then you know, you're able to kind of.
So some kind of classification is still required, but that could also be mechanized.
Right.
So, switching gears a little bit, and I don't know if your research has touched on this much, but we've been talking about the learning and the extinction of darting. Like, does that follow a similar time course that you would expect with freezing behavior? And is that something that, I mean, you mentioned the infralimbic, it's thought to always be involved in extinction. Well, the caveat, you know, the asterisk there, extinction of freezing behavior, you know, and in some ways, should we just be rethinking, you know, there's textbooks. I mean, you've got a class, you're talking about fear learning. Should we be, you know, have a giant asterisk by all of that and realize, well, this is actually just for in males so far, maybe something, and for one specific type of, you know, freezing or sorry, fear response. Should we almost throw that out with the, you know, or is there, how much redundancy do you anticipate there's going to be? Or is this going, you know, are we going to have new textbooks on every single type of behavior? And, oh, I mean, gosh. It gets larger and much bigger.
It definitely gets more complicated. So I definitely don't think we need to throw out the, you know, baby with the bathwater here. I think that Pavlovian fear conditioning is a great tool for studying learning. I just think that we need to think about what we are not, like think about what we've been ignoring during this task, because it seems on its surface so simple. It's like tone, shock, the animal puts it together, the end. And in reality, if you've ever done a fear conditioning study, I'm sure it's the same for repetitive conditioning, there are actually like a lot of decisions that you as the experimenter have to make in terms of setting up the experiment, in terms of the duration and intensity of the CS, the duration and intensity of the US, how far apart the presentations are, how many different things you're going to look at, how long they are, etc. It goes on forever. And so those things all contribute to whatever the behavioral data end up looking like. And that's just something that I think people don't consider as often as they should be. I feel like I kind of lost the thread on your question a little bit. But to answer your question about the IL, so we do see that darting extinguishes in the same way that fear, that freezing does, although when you start, right? So if you're doing an extinction study, the beginning of extinction, the animals usually freeze a lot. We don't see as much darting on that second day as we do during fear conditioning. So I do think that darting is, in a way, a behavioral response to the fact that it is learning that it is getting shocked. And it does it on the second day. Either it's the change of context, so darting may be a little more context dependent. We just don't see as much darting, which is why we really focus on the fear conditioning day and what it means to be a darter. So we're not necessarily interested, or where we've kind of landed is we're not really interested in darting itself as a conditioned response, but what it means about the animals that do dart and what's different about them. Why have they chosen to switch their behavioral strategies during fear conditioning? And what can that tell us about individual differences in threatening situations? Is there something that can, you know, that says anything about resilience or adaptability, behavioral flexibility? Those are the questions we're more interested in answering rather than simply adding more conditioned responses to how we study fear conditioning. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So I had a question with your, that sort of leads into like, So for a long time, people were only studying freezing, and then you started looking at darting. I'm sure there are like a million other behaviors that the rats are doing throughout these sessions. How do you sort of make the cuts of like, okay, this is a behavior that we're interested in and that we think is associated with fear versus this is a behavior that this rat's weird and it's just doing it, or this rat's bored so it's doing that? Like, how do you make those cuts?
So it did come down to, I mean, I think similar decisions when people decided to look at freezing for us. It was, what can we quantify? And when we first started noticing darting, the scanning behavior was another thing that we were like, we do see this fairly reliably, and we tried quantifying that as well. And it just wasn't, there wasn't quite as much scanning as there was darting. And so we were like, okay, we're going to pick one. All the other thing, you know, and again, this is about like our, the tools that we have. Darting, we were able to capture with the EthoVision, like by velocity. EthoVision can't tell you the animal is scanning. According right. to EthoVision, the animal is freezing, which is another problem because it's standing still. So it does, I think every little step is another, is progress. And so I think we could, you know, it may turn out that the animals that do scanning are like really interesting, but we kind of had our work cut out for us with all this whole darting thing. So someone else can look at scanning me.
So every one of our tools gives us this wonderful new insight, but it also restricts us to whatever that tool can do.
Yeah.
And blinds us to something else. So that's why it's so interesting to think that at least in some areas we might have tools that can work without binding us
too much. 100%. And I think it's really, you know, the more data we can collect about what the animals are doing across time in this very complex paradigm that doesn't just involve like the time that the tone is on, I think the better we're going to understand what it means to be in a traumatic situation that is complex and recurring. I think that's another aspect of this paradigm that people don't necessarily like think about too much, is about the change across time. They just think like, oh, it's an association and it's like a singular thing, but it's really not. It's something that builds. So yeah, there's a lot more work to do for behavioral neuroscientists for sure.
Good. I think that's a sure thing, and it's a good place for us to stop. So thank you very much, Rebecca, for joining us, and Matt and Morgan. This has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.